This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
This is The 11th Hour. I'm Páraic Branagh. Welcome to this week's selection from The 11th Hour podcast. The poet W.H. Auden was born 100 years ago today in the English city of York, and he had a writing career that spanned over half a century. And joining me now in the studio to talk about his life and work is poet and lecturer Gerald Daw. You're very welcome, Gerald.
Thanks, Páraic.
Auden was born in 1907. He died in 1973. Where would you place him in the context of 20th century literature?
Oh, he's one of the huge figures. I mean, maybe notwithstanding the centenary of this year, he may have drifted ever so slightly off the radar. But, I mean, when you look back historically, he is a colossus. His influence is immense. Throughout the English language speaking world, Auden would be one of the great, great, great poets of the 20th century. No doubt about that at all.
Many listeners will be familiar, unbeknownst to themselves, with Auden's poetry in Funeral Blues, which was famously used in the film Four Weddings and a Funeral. Would you describe Auden as populist, accessible?
Yes, I mean, one of the things about Auden, when I was thinking about him on my way here, I mean, he is a poet of contradiction. On one hand, he uses these great kind of almost folk traditions like the ballad and so on. He wrote lyrics for people to sing, and he wrote, you know, he's very much involved in cabaret and so on. So, I mean, there's a great populist side to Auden's writing. There's also another side, though, which is more philosophical, more metaphysical, more demanding, indeed more obscure. And it's the fact that he can straddle those two things, the popular, the populist, and the more difficult, the more challenging, the more questioning. The fact that he can have those two things, it's an unusual quality in a poet to be able to actually merge or engage with maybe the philosophical high questions of existence and God and religion and so on, and at the same time entertain. He's a great entertainer.
And no better this the film or the poem he wrote for the film Night Mill. What's the background to that?
Well, there was a film unit called the GPO unit, and basically what they were in the mid-30s, under the direction of a man called John Grierson. They went out and they tried to link together artists, cameramen, scriptwriters. Benjamin Britten also wrote a lot of the music behind this work. And basically what they were doing, they were trying to record and document the social life of ordinary people.
Auden had a problematic relationship with England. He left it, they considered he betrayed them.
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, I mean, I suppose we have more history of this in our own country, with writers leaving and, you know, sort of taking the Scunder to Dublin or wherever it may be. I mean, Joyce and Beckett going and Wilde and so on. But for Auden, it was a very emotional time. I mean, he left literally on the cusp of World War II. And there was a sense in which he never quite got over. There was a sense in which he had betrayed or left behind his people. Now, I mean, you can argue the toss about that. What was he doing? Was it wiser for him being...
But did he feel repressed because of his homosexuality?
Or well, no, I don't think it was so much that. Although, I mean, that would have been part preceding the war in the period of the late 20s and 30s. No, I think he felt that England itself, there was a generation of which he was one. Other writers, not quite so well known as Auden, like David Gascoigne, who felt that England was a shabby place and that they needed to go elsewhere. And America offered great options or alternatives to a writer like Auden. He wasn't the only one, of course. Christopher Isherwood, one of his friends, had gone there. And
they more or less went there together, really, didn't they?
Yes. And I also think that there was a lot about... it wasn't so much that they were leaving behind the people of the English people. They were leaving behind a kind of very certain kind of middle class upbringing, which in a sense Auden had rejected. But like all these things, you reject as a young and then you return older and you want to re-embrace it.
And did he?
Well, I think his coming home to England was an emotional and a moral thing. He did ask the question when he was offered the professorship of poetry at Oxford that he would not take it if it meant he had to give up his American citizenship or he was naturalised. So, I mean, I think it was a bone of contention with him right to the end. And of course, as you know, he spent most of his life outside of England, in Austria, Italy, America. He was an inveterate traveller. He was a man of the world in that sense. And I mean, I think sometimes we think, perhaps somewhat patronisingly, of English writers as being introverted. Whereas when you actually think about them from people like D.H. Lawrence on, I mean, they are great travellers. And they've written great books about travelling.
Auden wrote travel books, amongst other things. He was he had a wide range of interests.
Absolutely. I mean, he's probably greatest, he's best known for being a poet. But, I mean, he's a superb critic, magnificent critic, an anthologist, an editor. I was just showing earlier on the actual 8 volumes as his collected works are going to be. I mean, it's a vast compendium of work that goes through 2 volumes of his poems. But the other 6 are going to include plays, his literary journalism, and so on. I mean, the range is extraordinary. And I think that's possibly why, to come back to your original question, he is so influential. I mean, his essays, The Dyer's Hand, are marvellous essays for a young writer finding his or her feet. But there's also, I mean, he edited a volume of The Portable Greek. There's a famous anthology that he edited for schools, The Poet's Tongue. And it goes on and on. What fascinates me about Auden is his influence outside the English language world. I mean, one of the great inheritors of W.H. Auden was Joseph Brodsky, the Russian emigre.
American writer.
Who ultimately settled in America, yeah. And, I mean, Brodsky, in a series of essays published in Less Than One, talks, and he actually, this is actually his word, he worshipped Auden. And I think that there is that kind of awe that he inspires. And I think there are very few writers in the world today that actually summon that kind of awe just by the breadth of his achievement.
Well, we'd have to leave ourselves in awe of Auden. Thanks to Gerald Daw for giving us an overview of the life and work of W.H. Auden. The American writer, Edith Wharton, was a chronicler of New York's Gilded Age. She dug beneath the veneer to expose the snobbery and ruthlessness of that time. Hollywood has given Wharton's work a new lease of life, with film versions of The Age of Innocence, The House of Mirth, and Ethan Frome. Now the highly respected biographer of Virginia Woolf, Elizabeth Bowen, Hermione Lee has taken on Wharton as our latest subject, and she joins me now from Oxford. You're very welcome, Hermione Lee.
Thank you.
Edith Wharton was born in New York in 1862. Her family were a very rich industrial family, and they were a source of great inspiration to her, but her young life was not a happy one.
Yes, her family name was Jones. In fact, her childhood nickname was Pussy. So I thought of calling my biography Pussy Jones, but I thought maybe that wouldn't have the attention it deserved. Exactly. But the phrase "keeping up with the Joneses" was supposed to have been coined about her ancestors, and they were not exactly industrial. They made their money from land. They were old money, and they were sort of genteel, parochial, very conscious of, you know, doing the right thing, very conservative, rather Philistine. They thought that writers were a kind of exotic, dangerous species. And the idea that a young woman would grow up to be a writer was seen to be a very threatening one. And Edith Wharton, when she was a young girl called Pussy Jones, was always rushing away to make up stories when her mother would say, you know, "You've got to come and meet these nice ladies who are coming for tea." And she'd say, "No, no, Mama, I've got to make up." So she was a misfit from the start.
Her love life, her marriage, they weren't happy either, were they?
Well, she was not a very beautiful woman. She had red hair and a very strong, lively face and big feet, and she was shy and socially rather awkward. And she was married in her early 20s to a perfectly reasonable family choice, quite a bit older than her, a man called Teddy Wharton from Boston. And they didn't have children, and it seems like they didn't have much of a romantic or sexual life. And gradually, Teddy Wharton began to display symptoms of manic depression. And Wharton put up with this for a very long time. But it was clear that both emotionally and temperamentally and intellectually, he was not the right match for her. She had very good other friends, including Henry James, with whom she had very thriving intellectual relationships. And she had a somewhat tragic midlife love affair when she'd begun to move to Paris, lived in Paris quite a lot of the time. And she had an affair with someone who turned out to to be extremely unreliable, like a lot of the male characters in her novels, actually. So personally, in many ways, it was a rather unhappy life. But in lots of ways, she found very great satisfaction in her friendships and in her work and in her making of wonderful places to live.
Her main problem really was, at that time, she was a woman, and women had a certain space in that society.
Yes, there are, of course, always exceptions to that. And she was not, let's not get this wrong, she wasn't a bohemian, you know. She thought very ill of my previous subject, Virginia Woolf. She didn't have much time for the Bloomsbury group. She certainly wouldn't have described herself as a feminist or as a radical. She was quite conservative. When she moved from America to France, the circles she lived in were quite conservative and right-wing. There were a lot of sort of aristocracy amongst them and right-wing thinkers. But she certainly broke away from her genteel American, well-brought-up family's way of thinking. And she was very radical in her reading and very ambitious in her intellectual life. And, you know, a lot of women at that time were writing sort of sentimental poems and nice romances. And Edith Wharton was writing savage stories about divorce and suicide and adultery.
But she was 37 when she published her first novel. Was there some...
It's such an interesting point. Sorry to jump in, but a lot of women start late, don't they? Virginia Woolf, George Eliot, they have other things to do in their teens and 20s. And so she didn't break through till she was quite late, that's right.
Was there some moment prior to that, when she lived in New York, what was the moment that brought her to Paris? Was there something happened there that brought her to Paris?
It's not a sudden road to Damascus moment. All through her childhood and all through her young married life, she was travelling in Europe. She was very passionately Europhile, like a lot of her contemporaries, like a lot of Americans who felt that their real cultural life lay in Europe. And actually, her first great passion was for Italy, and she spent a long, long time writing about Italy and travelling in Italy. And then she gradually became more and more interested in life in France and French writing and French culture. And the thing that really dramatically changed things in her life was the war. She'd got divorced finally in 1913, and she hurled herself in the First World War into working for France, for which she was given the Légion d'honneur, which was hardly ever given to foreigners. And she was tremendously well respected as a French heroine, I mean, sort of, you know, Francophile heroine in France, in that she opened a lot of workshops and refugee homes and hostels for sick people. It's that, I think, that really committed her to France, yes, for the rest of her life. So after the war, she made two beautiful houses and gardens in France and lived there for the rest of her life till she died in 1937.
During the First World War, she was also active in trying to persuade America to come into the war.
She was. Everything she was doing was a kind of proselytizing. She once said, you know, if somebody asked me to get out of my grave and witness for France, I would do it. And she very much agreed with Theodore Roosevelt and indeed with Henry James that it was shameful of America not to intervene in the war. When they did intervene, she then complained a lot about how insensitive the Americans were in France. When the American Red Cross came into France, she complained a lot about how they were sort of clodhopping and didn't understand the French. And she actually wrote a little book called French Ways and Their Meaning, which was meant to interpret France to Americans, and something that still needs doing, by the way.
I was just going to say that book could be republished again any day.
It could.
The House of Mirth describes the oppressive New York society she grew up in. Was that kind of autobiographical?
Yes, it was certainly her breakthrough book. It was the book in 1905 which made her, you know, she was already wealthy, but this was a huge bestseller. And one of the reasons was, as you suggest, that it was very much about the world she knew. And her publishers, Scribner's, put a wrapper on the book which said, New York Society Unveiled. And she was very cross about that and said, you know, got to take this off. Though she was not averse to it selling a lot of copies because people rushed to buy it to see if any of their friends were in it. And it was clearly, I mean, this is a tragic story of a woman who is unmarried, very beautiful, has no protectors, and relies on her charm and her skill, her physical skills to hang on to high society, and gradually sort of slips down it, because she's she can never quite persuade herself to make a mercenary marriage. She has some other, you know, ideals. And in the end, you know, it's a moot point as to whether she kills herself, but she certainly dies tragically. Now, I wouldn't say that Lily Bart, this heroine, is an autobiographical character, but there's certainly a lot of Edith Wharton's feelings about her society and its ruthlessness and the kind of, you know, the way the marriage market is the next thing to prostitution, actually, for women of a certain class at that time. And all her feelings about that come very strongly into the book, yes.
But you mentioned that she was reticent about the publisher sensationalising her book. But did she need the money? Was she not independently wealthy?
Well, she did have inherited wealth, though there was. It's quite complicated because a lot of her wealth was tied up in trusts, the result of some family arguments between her mother and her older brothers. So she couldn't access quite as much as she would have liked. And actually, one of the curious things about Wharton's reputation is that people think she was this enormously wealthy woman who just wrote on the side. But in fact, more of her income came from her writing than came from inherited wealth. This is not to say she wasn't rich, but in the 30s, when her reputation began to slide and she began to be thought of as rather old-fashioned and fusty, she was actually very anxious about money and got into problems with her tax because she was worried about having to pay two lots of tax, both in France and America, and was constantly writing sort of potboiler stories for magazines in order to make money. So she was not absolutely in the clear. She wasn't, you know, she wasn't a Vanderbilt.
But she did appear up to visit friends with an entourage of three or four servants, drivers, and she had a huge entourage looking after a house. So she lived in a certain
style. She had altogether in her two French houses, I think, a staff of 22. And, you know, the two most kind of spoiled images of her are one that in between moving between her house just outside Paris and her house on the Riviera, she would get her servants to close down one house and open up the other house while she stayed in the Hotel Crillon in Paris. Now, this is not an impoverished life. The other image I love of her is her writing in bed in the morning and tossing the pages that she'd written over the side of the bed for the secretary to pick up and type out every morning. I mean, it's a great life, isn't it?
Fantastic.
We should be so lucky.
You know, but you can see why she wanted to write potboilers to maintain that lifestyle.
But you see, you know, I don't want to caricature her in the way that she often is caricatured, because actually the interesting thing about her is that she was a professional woman writer, and she also had a very objective and sardonic eye on exactly the kind of wealthy people that she grew up with. And there's a mistake about Wharton, which is to identify her too closely, you know, with these sort of idle rich. She isn't like that.
I suppose another mistake we make about Wharton is we often call her the female Henry James.
Yes, although one review at the time referred to her as the male Henry James, which did quite amuse her.
But they were friends, or they were acquaintances and correspondents.
It's a wonderful friendship. You know those friendships between writers which inspire one's imagination. James was the great maestro. He was 20 years older. He'd been to all the places in Europe before her. And when he met her, she was on the way up and he was on the way down. There's a famous story that she says she's bought a new car with the proceeds of her last novel. And he says, with the proceeds of my last novel, I've bought a small a hand barrow with which I'm going to wheel my guests' luggage from the train station to my house. And with the proceeds of my next novel, I'm going to have it painted. So he was very aware, you know, of the differences between them. And also he was then, he'd had a failure in the theatre. He was somewhat depressed. His brother died. He was publishing his New York edition, which was a tremendous flop, although he'd spent years working on it, while she was having these huge successes. So he would caricature her as a kind of angel of destruction, or an eagle, and she would be the eagle and he would be the worm. So there's a great playfulness, somewhat hostile playfulness too, between them, but they were very dear to each other, I think, and he was very much involved in her personal life, though as he burnt a great many of his letters, there are many secrets of Wharton's which he kept and put on his bonfire.
That's interesting, the burning of letters. Was there gaps in the information? Just to go back to the research and the creation of the book. Did you find gaps in your information? Did you have to go searching
There's both too much and too little. It's a very interesting subject for me, and I'm very fascinated by gaps in biography. I've written a little book called Body Parts, which is all about biography and what you do with the things that go missing. She was very private, as was James, as were many of her friends, and James burnt all but three of her letters to him, though his letters to her survived. And many of his letters say, "I am struck dumb with horror at what you have just told me in your last letter." And of course, you don't know what it is, which is very frustrating. But the key story like this, she had a lifelong, very, very close friend, possibly lover, we just don't know, a man called Walter Berry, who was very well-known American in France. He was a lawyer and very much involved with French life during the First World War. And when he died, she went into his apartment, which had been her apartment, the day after he died, and took all her letters and made away with them. So, you know, there are many huge gaps like that which simply can't be filled. Luckily for us, her letters to her lover did surface after years of sort of disappearance, and they were discovered not by me but by a previous researcher. So we do have that private part of her life.
We forget, though, a correspondence at that time, at the beginning of the last century, people wrote very intimate details in letters, perhaps what you wouldn't do now.
Yes, I mean, I don't know what biographers are going to do now. This is often a cause of dismay amongst biographers. There's going to have to be people searching in virtual space for people's emails, because the art of letter writing 3, 4, 5 times a day at great length to one's friends is something that has gone. So that paper trail is no longer very likely to be something that biographers can profit from.
In style, we think of Henry James as being the great writer of that area, with the detail of manners, of art, and society at the time. But was Wharton, as you suggested, a bit bolder than James as a writer?
They did have material in common. They often wrote about the same kind of subject matter, but I think they are tremendously different. And I think it's a disservice to her to think of her as, you know, this minor Henry James, or as one of my poet friend says to me, "Henry James goes to Hollywood," is what he always says when she's mentioned. And I get very cross because I think that's very unfair. I think she's bolder. I think she's more direct. I think she's more worldly in a way. And her sentences are much shorter.
There's no harm in that.
Well, I adore Henry James, and I don't think it's like people say, "Do you like Wolfe or do you like Joyce?" You know, "Do you like Wharton or do you like James?" Of course, one can like them both.
You mentioned Hollywood there, but it was Hollywood or the 70s that brought Wharton back into the frame, wasn't it?
There were earlier films, actually. I think they've all sunk without trace. There were some early, I think there were even some early silent movies. And she was very keenly aware of the possibilities there. She didn't think that was a bad thing. She certainly wasn't unworldly in that sense. She loved theatrical. There were quite a number of theatrical adaptations of her work in her lifetime. For instance, Ethan Frome, which, as you probably know, has a terrible sledding accident in it. Mm. And there's very funny correspondence from the actress Ruth Gordon playing Matty in Ethan Frome about how the sledge accident had to be done with a burly stagehand in the wings waiting to catch them as they came off the end of the sleigh. And so she liked all that. I think she would have been very pleased to see the films of The House of Mirth and The Age of Innocence, particularly the wonderful Terence Davis film of The House of Mirth.
It was the feminist movement in the 70s that sort of brought our novels back into focus.
I think that, yes, Virago published her in Britain, and I think that in America, the rediscovery of women writers and the rethinking of women writers as part of the wave of feminism in the late 60s and 70s was tremendously important for her reputation. I think she presents big problems for feminist interpretation. That is, that she is very taken up with the situation of women and the pressures on women and the, you know, the kind of late 19th century Ibsen Zola theme of the woman who pays is one that she's very interested in. But she is by no means a fully paid up feminist. And she was actually quite scathing in her private writings about the suffrage movement and about feminism.
But how was she interpreted by the 70s feminist movement? Was she seen as a chronicler of the patriarchal society of that time?
Very much so, and she is. But, I mean, having said that, there are a lot of very evil mothers in Wharton as well. She had a lifelong quarrel with the memory of her mother. She clearly got on extremely badly with her mother. There are many guilt-struck or incompetent or, you know, bad mothers, mothers that go missing. It's a very strong theme in her work.
The person herself, when she was growing up, she lived in a very repressed, formal household and society, which was quite harsh. But she was quite sharp and terse and harsh herself in her later life.
Oh yes, this is not a pussycat. I mean, this is a very tough-minded, self-made woman. I mean, she could have run a country. You know, she's an amazing. What Henry James in wartime called generalissima. She was the generalissima. She was enormously energetic, strong-minded, bossy. You know, she'd write a letter to people saying, you know, meet me at the station at 10 o'clock prontissimo or sharpissimo. You know, she was always making sure people would be on time, telling them which route to take, you know, exactly what she wanted bought for her, all that kind of thing. She could be very demanding. The great outpouring of energy that you get in her work is this tremendous intellectual power. And she's just enormously intelligent about the world she lives in. I mean, so that she, one of the things she's deeply interested in is anthropology and ethnography, and treating, as it were, the tribe of the group of people, the social group that she grew up in, as if through the lens of an anthropologist. And what she's fascinated by is the jostling of social forces, so that you have people trying to hang on to a way of life, to a custom of the country, whilst other people are moving in like buccaneers and trying to change things and disrupt things. And it's those social collisions that really fire her imagination.
That was a unique analysis of America at the turn of the last century.
Well, there were many people analysing America at that time. You have that big naturalist movement, you know, as so-called, where you've got those big masculine novelists like Theodore Dreiser and Frank Norris, Thomas Wolfe. You know, they're important figures. I don't think they're much read now. And you've got Scott Fitzgerald a bit later on, who is certainly, you know, holding American society up to a very glittering, clear light. So she's not alone, but I think she is unique in the way that she does it, where she'll take a very small, highly vividly described, highly defined social group, and through that small social group she'll cut down through it and show you the deep workings of social power.
You've mentioned that by the time the 30s came, her fame or her fortune was waning somewhat. Why was that? Was there a change of fashion, or had the world moved on, or what happened?
It's very interesting, that question. It's kind of double, actually, because you've got people like Faulkner writing something like Sanctuary or Light in August. You've got Faulkner writing what were then seen to be extremely shocking novels about rape and incest, taboo subjects. And so in relation to someone like that, she was seen to be genteel, old-fashioned, you know, outliving her era. But at the same time, it's noticeable when I looked into her correspondence with magazine editors and publishers, she's often turned down for family magazines in the 30s because her writing is too strong for them. So there's this... you know, there'll be a story which begins with the wife saying to the husband, if you don't give her up, the girlfriend, I will throw myself off the roof. He doesn't give her up and she throws herself off the roof, right? So a story that begins like this. This is not sort of gentle stuff. So there was a very odd paradoxical thing that on the one hand she was thought of as old-fashioned and passé, a grande dame, you know, of the 19th century. And on the other, she was actually found for the magazine trade to be too strong meat. And also there's another ingredient, I think, which is that although to a certain extent she caught on in France as a translated author, I think there was a feeling in the States in the 30s that she'd been away too long, you know?
Of course.
That she didn't, yeah, she didn't know enough anymore about how America really worked. And there's maybe some truth in that too. Actually, it's very interesting. Still, her post, you know, The Age of Innocence came out in 1920 and won the Pulitzer Prize and was very well known and is still one of her most well-known novels. She wrote, oh, a good half dozen novels after that, or more, actually. And these late novels are still very underread. And it's very interesting why that should be so. Some of them, I think, are very, very good. But they don't have the kind of nostalgic, you know, going back in time feeling that The Age of Innocence does, which is a novel written in the 1920 about the 1870s. Now, after that, she does try very hard to be modern, actually. She's very interested in modernism, although quite hostile to it in some ways. And so her novels are set very much in the present after that. And for that reason, I think, they were not so popular and still aren't. There's a wonderful 1928 novel called The Children, which I recommend to anyone who wants to explore a kind of slightly different bit of Wharton, which is a wonderful novel, very modern novel, very troubling, I think.
I'm really obliged to her, Manny Lee, for bringing Edith Wharton to life for us. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
The biography of Edith Wharton by Hermione Lee is published by Chatto & Windus. Jeremy Thomas has been described as one of the most adventurous independent producers in world cinema. Born in London, his career started in the 1970s when he worked as a film editor. From the cutting room, he moved into the office of producer and has worked with some of the world's most challenging directors, including Nicholas Roeg, Bernardo Bertolucci, Ken Loach and David Cronenberg. His latest film is Fast Food Nation, directed by Richard Linklater, which will be screened at the Dublin International Film Festival tomorrow night. Jeremy, you're very welcome to the 11th Hour.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk about your latest film, Fast Food Nation. This was adapted from an Eric Schlosser book, but it's not a straightforward adaptation, is it?
No, no, it's a sort of the book, which was a sort of book of facts and it's a book of information, which has been beautifully written, Eric Schlosser's book, about the fast food industry and the fast food world in general as a sort of metaphor for everything that's going on in a very quick way in a consumer society. So, you know, this book was very inspirational to a lot of people who read it, and in fact it was sort of on the bestseller list of the New York Times for a couple of years. And initially, you know, thought this book, well, how could there be a movie in it? But then, you know, somebody sort of clued me in, well, this can really be a dramatic film, not a documentary about the information, and that's when we started developing the film.
How do you create a fictional drama from a factual best-selling book?
Well, because, you know, there are characters who appear in the book who have taken some of these characters and made them into the characters of the movie, which is the immigrants who come to work in the fast food companies, the local people who work in the fast food, run the fast food business, and the management of the fast food company. So all those worlds come together.
Let's hear an excerpt from Fast Food Nation, testing out some of the flavorings.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, you like that? That's the barbecue big one.
Wow. Tastes like it's right off the grill.
You don't think it needs, like, liquid smoke or any other kind of flavorings?
No. No, no, no. I think it's perfect. Let's test that.
Okay. Try this one.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, these Caribbean seasonings are kind of tricky.
Well, we're calling them Calypso chicken tenders. I think people are going to have an expectation for maybe a touch of lime.
Oh, well, lime. Lime's easy. I just held back on the terpenoline on this to keep the flavoring subtle. But I can always go back and add more.
Yeah. Why don't you try that?
There are a few other films in this fast food genre, notably Morgan Spurlock's Super Size Me.
Yeah, Super Size Me. I mean, there's a fast food genre now. And of course, there's this sort of genre of films which are issue-driven films.
Can you get closer to the truth in fiction?
I think that you can get close to the truth, but then the truth hits you in the face because we have the same situation here in the UK where, you know, the turkeys and all the bird flu, and then it's found out how it's all happening, and you look at that, and there you've got a life imitating art because it's very, very similar to our story, and it's involving immigrant workers and food from other countries and very, very different ideas that we have about the food we eat. We have no idea.
The society has changed now that people don't prepare their own food anymore.
Well, I mean, you know, that's something that in the movie, it's sort of obvious, you know, the family meal has gone, you know, and our characters, the Patricia Arquette character, delivers her child, you know, only food out of the microwave, and what you think you're eating bears no relation to what you're eating. And that clip you played on, the very good clip you chose to play on the radio, you know, any flavor you think you've got in that is nothing to do with the flavor. It's to do with some group of chemicals that have been put together as flavorings, and they're on the side of the pack when you get it, and you look at it, you have no idea what it is. But that's the flavor of something that is approximates to what you think you're eating. So that was an eye-opener, seeing it being manufactured, being made, being produced in the millions from animals that have been farmed in ways that are unimaginable. So that was an eye-opener for me.
We're nearly in science fiction land, the way we're creating
well,
the nutrition.
Well, sort of it is, in a way, because when you think that these animals, for example, some of these animals, they never see the light of day. They're bred to, from birth to the table in a couple of months. You know, you get chickens with no feathers and just with breasts. Never see the light of day. Their beak, the beaks are trimmed so they eat more grain. It's an extraordinary business. But, of course, you know, that's to get a chicken nugget on the table.
Look, get back to your life as a film producer. You made Bad Timing with Ken Loach, Crash with David Cronenberg. How did you get to work on The Last Emperor with Bernardo Bertolucci?
Well, I just made a film called in Asia called Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
Of course, yes.
Which Bernardo had seen, and he saw this sort of British producer had been and made a film with Japanese people, which had become quite, you know, successful. And I knew his brother-in-law very well, and he said, we'd like to have lunch. And I said to him, I'd love to have lunch with you, Maestro, because I think your movies are wonderful films. And I chose a Chinese restaurant in Chinatown. And he said, listen, you know, I'm wanting to make a film in the Forbidden City. I want to make a film in China. I want to make the story of the last emperor, son of heaven, lord of 10,000 years, ruler of a quarter of the world, and he died happily as a gardener. And 60 years, it's this incredible story set against 60 years of turbulent history. And I said, yeah, I want to do that. But little did I know that it would be such an incredibly hard and an incredible adventure to go and make this first film in China, first feature film in China made by Western Crew, and getting into the Forbidden City and making that incredible film. It was certainly the biggest film experience I've had to date. And you know, going there and interacting in the sort of mid-80s to make that film was a life-changing experience.
It was a major cultural exchange.
Yeah, it was a big cultural exchange of people and ideas. Of course, the Italians were very happy to be there because they could say to the Chinese, you know, Marco Polo brought the noodles here. And there was always a big fight about which noodles. And, of course, there were the two kitchens at lunch because there was a lot of an Italian crew. And, you know, there would be all spaghetti and the Chinese noodles going for the different people working on the movie. There was a lot of food divide on that film as well, talking about food.
You had made Nagamisa Oshima's Merry Christmas, and that gave you sort of a skill in working in the Orient. Is it very different from working here in the West?
You know, they're very interesting to find somebody from another country to approach another world, like Oshima did in Merry Christmas. A Japanese director was did a prisoner of war camp in English, with it taught a very different approach to, say, Bridge of the River Kwai.
I was wondering about that. How did the Japanese audiences respond to that?
It was a very big hit in Japan because it had the big stars, the Japanese stars in it. And, of course, they were very... It turned into there was a sort of modern take on the prisoner of war camp film. And not only did it have sort of current-day stars in it, but also it showed a sort of male bonding in a way that was unusual for Japanese audiences to see a Japanese officer have an infatuation with a blonde British soldier. Quite radical to show in Japan when it came out. It was a quite controversial film, but it became very successful. And it's shown every Christmas still. They want to see Kitana to say Merry Christmas, and it's always shown on Christmas Eve.
Has the role of producer changed? You know, we have this notion of the old Sam Goldwyn model of producer. The producer says everything, does everything, and the director, the rest of the artists, kowtow. Is that the way it is these days?
No, I mean, that's a cliche of what a producer is. I mean, a producer obviously has to have some sort of a vision and a force to get the vision done or join the vision of somebody else. As the studio system has sort of gone away from us, we've sort of got independent production, films are cobbled together by lots of different sources of money. Often you get a lot of producers on a film because of somebody who brings you part of the money or brings you something else. They get a credit today. And I suppose there's you know, it'd been a proliferation of producer credits on movies, and it's hard for people to understand who is Sam Goldwyn on each film.
So you're looking forward to coming to the Dublin Film Festival?
I'm looking forward a lot to coming to Dublin tomorrow. I'm not thinking about raising any money for the Dublin Film Festival. It's not like Gambit. You know, it's a wonderful place to have film enthusiasts see a movie, and it's very nice being in the darkened room with other people emoting with a film.
I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th Hour podcast. The 11th Hour is live on RTÉ Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays at 11 p.m. From me, Pádraig Branach, and the rest of the team in the 11th Hour, Slán.